Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. Hello, everybody. David Sanger is our first guest today, WNYC contributor and the New York Times chief Washington correspondent. His current book is Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. So in that context, he's been watching Mitt Romney's trip to Europe and Israel and watching the developments in Syria. Hi, David.
Good to be back with you, Brian.
So the lead headline in the Times today is jihadists taking a growing role in Syrian revolt. And it says small groups of fighters from al-Qaeda, as well as homegrown jihadists, are taking more prominent roles and demanding a say in running the resistance. So, David, after more than a year of fighting in Syria, is this just now becoming apparent?
Well, it's becoming apparent now because there is something of a vacuum, a power vacuum that's occurred now in Syria that we didn't have before. You know, until a few months ago, Assad pretty well had control over all of his territory. And al-Qaeda and jihadists grow where the state collapses. That's why they went to Afghanistan in the late 90s and, you know, early 2000s before 9/11. Mm-hmm. That's what the concern was, misplaced about Iraq. But, of course, al-Qaeda did come to Iraq after Saddam Hussein was gone. And I think you're seeing the same thing now. It's a real target of opportunity. Also, there's every likelihood that, you know, if you look at the scenarios ahead for Syria, that what you just get is a low-grade or maybe high-grade civil war for some period of time in which the rebels and other groups have different parts of the territory, and al-Qaeda wants a piece of that action. It's never before been available to them.
The article says even less zealous resistance groups are taking on a more Islamist aura because it attracts foreign money.
Yep.
Who's contributing to the Syrian rebels based on their Islamist leanings and al-Qaeda ties?
Well, not entirely clear to any of us because the money flows are, you know, even more mysterious than the money flows in, say, a presidential campaign, right?
And that's pretty mysterious.
But in the past, al-Qaeda elements and Taliban elements have always gotten support indirectly from Saudi money. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's the Saudi government, but it may mean sympathizers in Saudi Arabia, but also throughout the region. And then you always have the possibility that you get, you know, side bets that are being put on here by people who either want to destabilize Assad or people coming in on Assad's side, or those who worry, and here again the Saudis would be a big example of this, that if they don't back the rebels, Assad and the Iranians win. And so you've got sort of Sunni money coming in against Shia money, the Iranians, of course, having supported Assad because the Alawite party that he runs is pretty close to the Shia.
And so the U.S. angle on this, as the Obama administration continues to resist calls for sending arms to the rebels, does this tend to help make his case, or does it speak more to a void of U.S. support for the rebels, which created the vacuum that Islamist money is filling?
Well, there's another way to look at it, Brian, which is if you're wondering why the administration has been reluctant to fund the rebels, you know, Secretary Clinton has said on several occasions that she was concerned because she didn't know exactly who these rebels were. They were not exactly a unified group, and while we tend to sort of imagine them as freedom fighters, some of them showed up in a video the other day with an al-Qaeda flag behind them. You can see this in a YouTube video that came out last weekend, or I guess about a week ago now. And as I've talked to intelligence officials who have been reviewing this, they're still trying to figure out whether or not this was really homegrown al-Qaeda or whether it was al-Qaeda just coming over the border from Iraq, which seemed just as likely. But can you imagine what it would be like if the United States funded the rebel groups and then it turned out that some of those arms, either directly or indirectly, ends up in the hands of rebels who are also al-Qaeda?
Right.
That would not be a good situation.
As happened once upon a time, as you pointed out, after the Afghanistan war. But on the other hand,
We've seen this movie.
But we've seen it a few ways, because there was also a kind of scare tactic to try to keep the U.S. out of Libya by saying there was a whiff of al-Qaeda among the rebels there, which doesn't seem to be turning out to be true. So you could err on either side.
You can, and, you know, what's true this month may not be true next month. So you can come in on the behalf of some rebels whose goals you think you share, and then once enough chaos is created, jihadist elements, whether they're al-Qaeda or something related, see their opportunity and come in.
Right.
And it's one of the reasons you want to make sure that you have sort of a unified rebel command. Well, in Libya, they were a bit more unified. They weren't terribly unified, but they were more unified than they are here in Syria.
So John McCain seems to be on TV every other day pushing the idea of the U.S. arming the rebels and accusing Obama of lack of leadership for not doing so. Here's McCain on Face the Nation last week.
We should get arms to them so that we can balance the forces. It's not a fair fight. My question is to the Secretary of State and the President of the United States is, how many more have to die before we take action to help these people?
So, David Sanger, do you know if John McCain has reacted to these revelations yet about growing al-Qaeda and other jihadist influences among the rebels?
I haven't seen any reaction from him, but it's not a new issue. I mean, the video that I mentioned before with the al-Qaeda flag behind some of these rebels came out weekend before this past one, and that was just as Senator McCain was speaking on Face the Nation. So he's aware of the problem. It's basically a balancing act. The question is, what's the greater evil here? Is it better to support the rebels and get rid of Assad? Or is it better to sort of hang back, assume the rebels sooner or later are going to win because Assad is so weakened, but not have the arms kicking around? It's a real short-term, long-term trade-off, because as we learned in Afghanistan, long after the rebellion is over, the weapons are still there.
And what about Romney, who's in the Middle East right now, or maybe he's flying out right now, but he's been there the last few days. Has he been echoing McCain's call for arming the rebels? Has Romney taken a stand one way or the other?
It's been a very subtle shift from the McCain wording, at least as far as I've seen. He has said that the U.S. should be doing far more to support the rebels. But that's a different thing from saying that you should send arms to them.
That's a different thing from saying how you should support the rebels.
That's right. And, you know, so if you're running for president and you don't have to actually make the decision about whether or not you're going to provide support and in what form, it's much easier to fuzz it up, a lot harder for President Obama to fuzz it up because he's got to go revisit that decision each and every day. And, you know, that's the wonder of presidential campaigns. And, you know, you've seen this as well in the Iranian negotiations, and, you know, as they have gone on and as that has become a political issue as well.
David Sanger, my guest on WNYC, New York Times chief Washington correspondent and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. That's the book that revealed some of the American role in the Stuxnet virus against Iran and some other things. So let's stay on Mitt Romney in the Middle East because he's got another international backlash taking place this morning. He didn't have enough of those in England, so he had to start another firestorm in Jerusalem. And what do you make of this? Apparently, at a breakfast this morning with Jewish donors, he said that their culture is part of what has allowed them to be more economically successful than the Palestinians. And this, of course, has outraged Palestinians who are calling it a racist remark. Romney said, quote, as you come here and you see the GDP per capita, for instance, in Israel, which is about $21,000, and compare that with the GDP per capita just across the areas managed by the Palestinian Authority, which is more like $10,000 per capita, you notice such a dramatically stark difference in economic vitality. So what was Romney trying to do, and did he put his foot in his mouth with another gaffe, or is he doing something intentionally here?
Well, I think it was fairly intentional. He was obviously playing to the audience directly in front of him in Israel, and he was playing to a Jewish-American voting group back at home who've been watching this trip very intensely. Look, this is always – it's always dangerous stuff when you're comparing – different countries, different cultures, and then comparing their economic performance and trying to assess whether or not there are cultural factors involved. And you've seen many politicians run into these shoals before. They've done it on racial lines. They've done it on ethnic lines. You can even see it in geographical issues. You hear occasional politicians getting in trouble in California asking the question why the same set of circumstances that has allowed Silicon Valley to become so wealthy hasn't worked across the bay in Oakland. So whenever you do this and you attribute it completely to cultural purposes, you're bound to get some backlash. Now, I think that was less of a backlash than what he's likely to get from declaring that he would move the capital to Jerusalem and that Jerusalem was the true capital of Israel, something that three American presidents, the past three American presidents, Democrats and Republicans alike, have declined to do while in office because, of course, it would end up killing the Palestinian Israeli negotiations, which all have to do, or partly have to do, with how you sort out the various claims to Jerusalem.
Well, I'm not sure that declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel, and I realize what a political football that has been, necessarily thwarts a final status agreement, because it could still be split up into some portion of East Jerusalem goes to the Palestinians or
Absolutely.
Becomes jointly administered or however they work it out.
Yeah. But he didn't allow for that possibility. I mean, he didn't raise that possibility in his comments, at least in the comments that I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't go back to the Bush formulation about that. Now, as
president, he went further than Bush.
That's right. He President Bush was always careful to say two states side by side, and when you asked his aides, would say Jerusalem to be negotiated and so forth. That's not the kind of specificity that you play if you're a presidential candidate, particularly if you are Mitt Romney, who mm-hmm. has been, trying to be pretty vague on most of his pronouncements on all foreign policy issues
right.
to allow him the maximum latitude.
As on Syria, but he's being specific on Jerusalem. So back to the culture thing for a minute. I'm reading the Daily News account of this now. It says Romney, seated next to billionaire casino owner Sheldon Adelson at the head of the table, told donors at his fundraiser that he had read books and relied on his own business experience to understand why the difference is so great. Quote, "And as I come here and I look out over this city and consider the accomplishments of the people of this nation, I recognize the power of at least culture and a few other things." So one thing that strikes me as weird about that is that Arab culture is very entrepreneurial and capitalistic in historic terms. Israel, ironically, was founded on a socialist principle. It was supposed to be kibbutzes, kibbutzim, and things like that, though they, of course, moved away from that. But the Arabs have a reputation as serious hagglers and tough negotiators, a lot like Jews do, by the way, and maybe it's a stereotype in both cases. But also because of oil and other things, many Arab countries are very well off in global terms. So when he tries to make a distinction between Jewish culture and Arab culture or Palestinian culture, what is he actually talking about?
Well, it seems pretty fraught. And I guess the reason that the Palestinians reacted so strongly is that they would read it as his saying that this was a superior culture and that, therefore he was making an argument for perhaps why Israel should have the advantage in everything from territory to other issues of dispute. But it's not the only time where you have seen politicians struggle with this kind of question. We spent the 50s, 60s, and 70s denouncing the Chinese as a communist country. And spent the 80s, 90s, and this decade worrying whether or not their culture is more attuned to capitalism than many others, perhaps including our own, because of their unwillingness to create social safety nets and so forth and just compete more brutally. So it's almost always an argument that is A, unprovable, and B, bound to get a politician in trouble with the group that he is maintaining is not culturally up to to the competition.
We're almost out of time with David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, who largely follows foreign affairs. I just want to touch base, because I guess this happened after our show on Friday, or as it was going on Friday, on the London remarks. In case you missed them, folks, on Friday, one of my producers made the joke here that even before the Olympic Games began, Romney won a gold medal in the back pedal. And that, of course, was for having said that Britain wasn't entirely ready for the Games and then eating those words. So on the London remarks, in case you missed them late on Friday, here is Romney before.
You know, it's hard to know just how well it will turn out. There are a few things that were disconcerting. The stories about the private security firm not having enough people, the supposed strike of the immigration and customs officials, that obviously is not something which is encouraging.
And here is Romney after the British press attacked him.
My experience as an Olympic organizer is that there are always a few very small things that end up going not quite right in the first day or so. Those get ironed out. And then when the games themselves begin and the athletes take over, all the mistakes of the organizing committee, and I made a few, all of those are overwhelmed by the many things that the athletes carry out that capture the spirit of the games.
I made a few, of course, a reference to Romney's running the 2002 Olympics in the United States. One of the reasons why he's going to London at all to try to associate himself with the Games, so Americans remember that part of his resume. But, David, now that we've had 3 days of hindsight after the breathless stuff on Friday, do you think that was actually a gaffe, or was it Romney just telling the truth and then being sideswiped by some misplaced sense of etiquette?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, he was speaking something that clearly the British have said themselves in criticism of their own organization.
Constantly.
And he was echoing that. But what really ran him into trouble was that Prime Minister Cameron then came out and said, well, it's easy to run an Olympic Games if you're doing it in the middle of nowhere. A clear reference to Salt Lake City, where Mr. Romney ran his Olympics. So saying, you know, try it in a big, bustling city of 7 million, right? It was just tone deaf. It wasn't that anything that he said was wrong. It was sort of where and when he said it. I think the harder issue for him, Brian, is going to be sort of where he put himself on the Iran issue when he was in Israel yesterday, and he basically took a position that was much closer to the Israeli position about how much nuclear activity you could tolerate on the Iranians' part than on the U.S. position, not only President Obama's but President Bush's before him. And I suspect that as we look back over the totality of the trip, that's probably going to end up being the bigger issue.
So here's Romney yesterday on that in Jerusalem.
We should employ any and all measures to dissuade the Iranian regime from its nuclear course. And it is our fervent hope that diplomatic and economic measures will do so. In the final analysis, of course, no option should be excluded. We recognize Israel's right to defend itself and that it is right for America to stand with you.
So, David, just help me understand, because the Times article on this today, which you contributed to, says there was a subtle difference between Obama saying Iran must be stopped from developing a nuclear weapon and we hold all potential means, including military, on the table, between that and Israel's language echoed by Romney that Iran must be stopped from even having the capability to develop one. What's the actual difference?
That's exactly the distinction. It's not quite captured in the clip you played,
right,
but it's a big difference in how you approach the problem. President Obama has said we can't in the end let them get a weapon, but has never addressed the question of what do you do if Iran's strategy, as many believe it is to walk right up to the edge, have the fuel, have the expertise, and have the ability to screw it all together in a period of weeks or months. What Governor Romney said was, we're not even going to let them get the capability, which has been the Israeli position. The difficulty is that they're so close to the capability now that if you took that position literally, you might have a much shorter time frame to a military conflict. And, of course, what President Obama is trying to do is give this a little bit of time for diplomacy and for the sanctions to work and for the sabotage, which I described in the book, as you you discussed, but is also, you know, presumably ongoing in other forms, to take its effect as well.
So does the U.S. campaign season make it more or less likely, or neither, that Israel might actually attack Iran in the short term, in these coming months?
It's very hard to know, and you saw Tom Donilon, the president's national security advisor, go to Israel just a few days before Mr. Romney arrived, and presumably this was on the agenda, though the White House has not talked about what took place in those discussions with Prime Minister Netanyahu. But I think you raised just the right question, because there's one calculation, we've talked about this before, in which the Israelis might conclude that it's better to attack before the election, because President Obama could not say anything about it, could not criticize them prior to the election. He could after. On the other hand, if the Israelis think that Governor Romney is really going to win, and they believe that what he's saying on the campaign trail reflects what his policy will be like, they may think that they'll have the U.S. as an ally to join in an attack in the future if they needed them. So it's a very hard calculation. This calculation also affects the Iranian decisions about whether to negotiate with President Obama or not.
Last thing, we talked about Romney winning the Olympic gold for the backpedal in London. Now I'd say he's going on to his track and field event, which is the leap of faith, for going finally to Poland. And
perfect.
Think the media is going to actually pay attention when he goes there. If this is supposed to be a capital of the world trip, three capitals of the world, and yes, one is London, and yes, another is Jerusalem, why is the third leg Poland?
The third leg is Poland because Poland has been sort of the most reliable American ally that was once under Soviet domination. And you're going to hear Governor Romney make the case that President Obama abandoned them when he shifted the strategy on missile defense, which relies less on a missile defense outpost in Poland and more on one that floats off of the Iranian coast. And so he's going to make the argument that this undercut a major American ally. My guess is that's probably not going to have a lot of traction back here, just because, as you say, it's a little complicated to understand why it is that he's in Poland instead of one of the major capitals. He's not going to Germany. He's not going to any of the places that are at the center of the financial crisis in Europe.
Let's see. Poland, which Gerald Ford couldn't get right, was under Soviet domination in the 1976 presidential debate, right?
That's right.
And which President Bush brought up as, don't forget about Poland. We have a big coalition of the willing in Iraq.
Right.
So we will see what role it plays in the 2012 presidential election. And if it comes up in the debates this year, today, 99 days before the presidential election in the United States. And we thank David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent, for talking about Romney's trip and al-Qaeda influence rising in Syria. His current book is Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be back with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, a call-in for anyone with ties to the Midwest on the drought that's plaguing the Farm Belt and that could affect everybody's food prices. Stay with us.